I'd like you to welcome all of you to our Science and Security Seminar. I'm delighted to present Dr. Patrick Fitch this afternoon, Director of the National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures Center, and he's also President of Battelle National Biodefense Institute, which is the organization that won the $250 million five-year contract to manage and operate the NBAC. And I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more about that as the talk proceeds. The title that I made up that they let me use here at CSIS is Senior Fellow for Science and Security. And I really can't think of a better example of where these two realms intersect than today's talk. So I'm particularly delighted to be able to host Dr. Fitch here and to have you all here. Looking at today's turnout and reviewing some of the literature that one can see about this particular facility, it's clear that there's a lot of interest in what Dr. Fitch is going to be talking about. And I think this interest comes from at least three directions. From the health and safety perspective, the residents of Frederick, Maryland in the first instance and all the rest of us in the second have an interest in ensuring that the high containment biological laboratories that NBAC will comprise can safely and securely manage the biological organisms that they'll be studying. From a point of view of its technical agenda, the challenge of translating the mission of filling information gaps to better understand current and future threats, turning that general charge into a specific research program is going to be quite a challenge. And finally, the sensitivities that this institute calls in regard to United States adherence to international obligations, particularly given this center's mission of understanding but not improving potential adversaries' ability to use biological weapons, the tensions posed by that mission as well contraposed with the mission of providing assurance to domestic and international observers that this country is indeed complying with international agreements such as the Biological Weapons Convention pose yet another set of challenges that all have to be blended in this one facility. So given the active public interest in this facility, it's understandable that over the past there's been quite an amount of speculation as to what this is actually up to. Much of the speculation has been fueled by a PowerPoint presentation from 2004 that many more people, I would suggest, have seen over the Internet than had a chance to see it in person. And those who have seen it over the Internet have not had the advantage of having the soundtrack that went along with it. So relying on something like that is certainly understandable in the absence of anything more current, but we're fortunate today to have a four-year update delivered by the person who would know with the soundtrack to find out what this NBAC is all about and what it's going to be doing in the future. We are recording this event to be able to show it as a webcast later on through the CSIS website, and I believe there are also members of the press here who will be recording it as well. So when it comes time for questions and discussion, I'll ask you to identify yourself, and I'll ask you to realize that the world will be listening to you as well. So thank you. Dr. Fitz.
Thanks, Chair. Let's see, I'm going to suggest that you feel free to interrupt me as I go through. The charts are meant to document things that I anticipated, and in the discussions before we started, several of the questions I've attempted to address in the charts were asked. But if you'd like to interrupt me, feel free. If I feel like we're falling behind and there's too much material left to cover, I will ask for sort of a hiatus from the questions and speed up through the rest of the charts and try to get the chance to give the overview that's in here. We have two main things in our mission. Threat characterization. Can you see through me? Okay. Threat characterization and forensics. And based on the agenda Jerry just described, I'm going to give short change to the forensics. I'll say a few things about it and then move on and spend most of the time talking about threat characterization because I think that aligns with the kinds of questions that were in the abstract for the talk. These two mission areas that we do to support the Department of Homeland Security fit within a broader federal program in biodefense, and by no coincidence fit within an actual geographic alignment at Fort Detrick, which is called the National Interagency Confederation for Biological Research, and the National Interagency Biodefense Campus. And on the right side of the chart, you'll see the different agencies that have facilities going up. Ours is the one in the lower right, which is under construction, the NIH facility, the Integrated Research Facility, which is just below and to the left of that, is also around the same pace of construction. Both will open sometime either later this year or early next year. And by open, I mean the construction will be done. USAMRID, the U.S. Army Research Institute for Infectious Diseases currently has a facility there. We lease space from them for our forensics activities, and they have a phase one construction plan that they would like to start soon. So just an update on the building, which, by the way, I'm not responsible for construction of the building, didn't design it. The contracts are held by another part of DHS. This is one of those good news, bad news things for scientists, right? You kind of want control of the building. On the other hand, there's a lot of headaches that go with finishing construction. You can kind of see the lower left just over a year ago when the bottom floor had been poured. The entryways to the right, it looks like a ship from above. And since the current Undersecretary for Science and Technology is a retired admiral, we use a lot of ship analogies. The middle section, which is where the BL3 level labs are, you can see from above. And the left section, which still had no concrete on it as of March of 2007, is where the BL4 foundation, the floor foundation is. So from the front side, rather than above, entryway to the right, administrative space, BL3 space, BL4 moving right to left. So a lot of construction has been done in a year. Key dates, in 2004, so NBAC predates the FFRDC that I run. The interim forensics capability was brought up in the lease space at USAMRID, and the threat characterization program was started. These were managed by Department of Homeland Security. The facility design began a year later. Construction began 2006. I think groundbreaking was in June. We won our contract the very end of 2006, rounding up to 2007 to make everything happen one year at a time. Complete construction expected December of this year. We'll move into the administrative space. We have a lot of stuff to do once we get access to the building, everything from CDC inspections to making sure all the protocols that maintain our ISO coverage for forensics, all of that can move into the building. That'll take at least 6 months. And so my prediction is the earliest we'll be doing any BioLevel 3 work will be June of 2009. And the BL4s will lag 3 to 6 months behind that, assuming everything in the facility works just fine. Full operation is 2010, and again, that's assuming everything goes smoothly. Several people asked me, and the way Jerry described it, I think, shined a little light on what BNBI is. We're a single-purpose limited liability company. And by single purpose, that means any money I receive as president of that company comes in from a contract that Department of Homeland Security holds. It's a little odd in that the contract's actually administered by USAMRA, which is part of DOD. So there's that little extra step in it. Most of the Department of Energy labs, if you're familiar with the national labs, it would be straight DOE to the limited liability company. In our case, it's held by USAMRA in between. Doesn't change the FFRDC relationship in any way. It's just an administrative step. BNBI, the company I'm president of, is a wholly owned subsidiary of Battelle, which is a nonprofit 501c3, who where profits, if you will, our earnings, go to philanthropic giving like science and technology education programs. We as a subsidiary are not a 501c3, but our earnings go to the same pool. So essentially we are, but for IRS tax purposes, I can't say I am. We bring, as part of the Battelle family, a best practices management and operations. I take full advantage of access to the other lab directors, whether it's a 10,000-plus person lab or a much smaller lab. We seek to extract the best parts we want from that, improve on that, take advantage of the fact we're both a small biotech company, and I get access to the 20,000-person Battelle family as well. Before I talk about the programs at all, there's some other things that we put in front of the programs, safety being the top of that. I wasn't going to give a detailed description of our safety programs and the like, but happy to answer questions about that. Security, which I will end up talking about on and off, I'm sure this will be part of the questions. Business practice is another area that we have a lot of areas that we've established since standing up a year and a half ago. Regulatory compliance, I might comment on. In addition to what I do internally, the Department of Homeland Security has a separate group, so not part of the program chain, so it's not part of where our money comes from, that has to approve every project before we start it. So every single project NBAC, even if it's not in the threat program, goes through this compliance review before we're up, and I need to have a certificate on file. So it's very similar to the way IBC committees and human subjects committees work. Don't have it on file, don't do the work. We also have what I think are starting to become standard review and release processes. We administer these both after the work and before, and some of these are based on the NSAB guidelines. Others are classification-based, and some are actually policies that encourage the publication, and I might comment on some of the mystique that went with NBAC, I think is accredited to the request for proposals and before that, and in the RFP you can read, and it basically said all your employees need to have top secret clearances and you will not publish. So we showed up 2 weeks later to take over, and I was asked at this kickoff meeting, well, what do you think of that policy? And I explained a half dozen reasons why I thought it would hurt us in terms of our science, it would hurt us in terms of our international relations, and I'm sure it wasn't what I was saying that was going to change anything, but the answer was, that's great, we're not going to do it that way anymore. So in fact, we're about to have added to our performance measures a publication requirement. So I fully expect, and we don't have all our labs yet, so obviously I don't think we're going to be cranking out journal articles in the next year or two, but I fully expect over 80% of our work will be published. And where I'd also like to get, and I apologize for not being able to do it today, I would like to be able to provide a list of every project we do, even if the results of those projects are classified, again, as part of the overall confidence building measures that we can do. I don't have permission to do that today. I apologize. Okay, so the way we're organized and the way we set up our programs, we have three plans that set our internal management expectations. One is a strategic plan that's developed jointly between myself and the Chem Bio Division at Homeland Security. And that strategic plan is basically a five-year horizon. And we have an annual plan, which is the implementation of the strategy against a single fiscal year's budget. So obviously, you know, the strategic plan is, wow, wouldn't it be great if, or to use more ship analogies, what ocean am I in and what port am I heading towards? And then the reality is whether you have a speedboat or a sailboat or a windsurfer come to bear, and you get on board with whatever size ship you can afford. And that's the annual plan. And no matter what scale it is, once a year we formally write down, and we just finished doing this, areas for improvement. And this areas for improvement come from our own self-assessment, our customers like the FBI, other stakeholders in the federal government and users, and that becomes our multi-year performance improvement plan. Because not everything you want to improve can be done in a few months. Many things are, but some of them are much bigger than that. We have a variety, and someone asked me before we started about peer review. There's a variety of different levels of peer review. So at the institutional level, what processes I use as opposed to like the project level, I have a science and technology advisory committee that Dr. Rita Caldwell chairs for me. It's a very small group, a fairly prestigious set of individuals. And basically, they look at all the processes. If there's program areas they have an interest in, we do deep dives for them in those areas. Two-thirds of them hold clearances, so we can go into the classified work as well. Now, they are picked by me and approved by me, and so there's another committee, which is the National Academies Committee, which is not picked by me, not approved by me, and the Department of Homeland Security sets the agenda for briefing those, that committee. There's also an annual program review, and then within our own management, every project we do that's funded externally, it goes through a peer review. So we have two subcontracts basically for performing peer reviews, and we use those to get feedback on the quality of the proposals. So if they're competing proposals, you know, they're normal sort of NIH-style ranking, and if there's one proposal, we use the peer review for go, no-go, as well as how to improve it. I already mentioned the compliance review, and then internally, we have an ISO 17025 system in place for forensics. We're in the process of expanding an overall ISO set, ISO 9001. We're waiting to activate that until we get in the new building, so that'll probably be a year into the new building. We have a mandate to not lose our 17025 as we move, which is actually a harder standard than establishing 9001, so we're trying to do them both simultaneously, for those who are familiar with ISO. There's three programs. I'm not going to talk about NBFAC, the Forensics Analysis Center, other than to say it is operational. It's in lease space at USAMRA. It includes a biosafety level 3 laboratory, and we've basically processed thousands of samples for law enforcement and biocrimes and the like. Our role is the technical forensics, not attribution. That's the job of law enforcement. The two programs I am going to talk about some more are the threat characterization and CORE. And so threats were most of the issues Jerry introduced are going to be discussed, but CORE I added as well because it's our sort of anti-buggy whip factory program. It's our scientific futures program. It's a very small program, but I think it's worth hearing about because one of the challenges and the reason I was excited to come here is, you know, how do you predict the future? And I don't have a crystal ball anywhere despite what the picture shows. And so ideas on how to better get our handle around strategically what types of things are in the future is very useful for us. So the feedback on that is quite valuable. So in the context of forensics versus threat, the forensics question would be, is that ricin on the left and is that Bacillus anthracis on the right? The threat question is, which one represents a greater risk? And so how do you do that? And you have to put this kind of in historic context. What if you don't structure an overall assessment for doing this as is requested or required in Homeland Security Presidential Directive 10? If you don't do that, what happens is people come in, and if you're an expert on ricin, then you argue, here's why I think ricin's a threat. And if you study Bacillus anthracis, you argue why Bacillus anthracis, and you kind of chase your tail. Well, gee, neither one of them is contagious. Well, you left out plague and smallpox. Maybe those are worse. Let's jump over there. And so there's a real value in structuring the conversation, even if you don't know the answer to certain key parameters. And be the first one to say, we don't know the answer to certain key parameters, and I'll go through sort of what we're trying to do about that. So how did we define risk, or how did the department define risk? Likelihood times consequence. And a lot of times in biodefense, people will talk about consequence only. And so you'll see the singular scenario under which this horrific event happens and hundreds of thousands of people would die. And those are worth understanding. A risk assessment has to weight that by the probability of that occurring, so the likelihood. And that's one of the things that's counterintuitive about the risk assessment, is when you do that averaging, sometimes those big spikes sort of go away, and sometimes they don't. And one of the things a formal risk assessment lets you do is understand what it is you might change to have lots of those big spikes go away, or what it is you have to do to take an overall risk down, or where is it that you really don't understand what's going on because you see these large error bars, and I'll show you some examples of that in a second. So our goal is to use science and to base a risk assessment on scientific evidence to capture both references and to be able to point to those references and also to identify areas where it's strictly a scientific consensus and the evidence is either not there or is weak. In other cases, it's consensus of other types, and it really is just subject matter experts coming together and saying, this is the range of values we think might be represented here. And so it's not magic, but there are parameters where it really is no more information than people who work with, say, rickettsia getting around saying, here's what we think about rickettsia. The mathematical formalism, I won't go into this in any great detail, is to use several layers of decisions where each of these represents a decision by an adversary. So an adversary picks an agent, the far left of this flow chart here, with some probability that agent was selected. Once that's picked, where are they likely to attack? That's another decision that an adversary has to make. And then once that's decided, that type of attack, how is the agent produced? How is it delivered? And so you go through this and you multiply out all these probabilities, and it's a fairly complicated system, and in fact it's done something like Monte Carlo, if you're familiar with that type of simulation, where basically the probabilities are sampled hundreds of thousands of times on a large computer, and those come back and we weight those out, and that's a ranking of the risk or a relative risk. And so this again is a formalism, a way to collect it all. You can go back and say, well, this thing makes no sense to me, this result here makes no sense, and track back why did that end up where it did, and then challenge parameters. And so it's much more structured. Is it perfect? No, of course not. But it does allow you then to go back and change the parameters. Someone can come in and say, I don't believe that the following agent is hard to get, and here's why I say that. And so you can rerun the code and say, let's suppose it's sold at Walmart. Anyone can get it. What does it change? Does it change the risk substantially, or does it not change it at all? And if it doesn't change it a lot, then let's stop arguing about that parameter, because even if we're wrong, it doesn't matter. So the components of this study, sort of a different way, I'm going to say the same thing three or four different ways here, at least I hope I'm saying the same thing, is adversaries' capability. So what is it they're looking to do, and are they able to do it? So some part of these probabilities is an adversary decides, I want to use this agent. If that's an agent that's very hard to grow, very hard to gather, very hard to get access to, the odds of them being successful is low. So that changes that probability. So it looks less likely to us that they would select it. Likewise, if you go through the probability tree and say they did select it, the odds of them making a lot of it seem lower. And all these things connect logically, and they're all stacked in those trees. To do some of this, you have to know the characteristics of the agent, and the studies aren't done, obviously, just by us. In fact, the majority of them are done by places like NIH, the basic science of what are the pathogen characteristics for each of these agents on the CDC select agent list or the USDA list and the like. And those are very important parameters for many of the scenarios we look at. And then finally, there's vulnerabilities, and this is where the sensitivities come in. I mean, all the rest of this is fine and can be theoretical. The second you take, here's something that looks likely and we're not prepared for it, that to us in DHS looks like something I shouldn't be standing up talking about publicly. And so that's where a lot of our security guidance comes in, is how to protect information that would disclose a vulnerability. So on the right side here, the picture is an example of the type of product that comes out of the bioterrorism risk assessment. So the dot in the middle is the mean assessed risk. It's on a relative scale, starting at the top is 10 to the 0 or 1. It is a log scale, so every one of those dashed horizontal lines is a factor of 10 lower risk than the dot line above. So what you see here in this cartoon, is three clusters. I mean, cartoon designed to give the three clusters. And so if we were assessing risk here, we might say, gee, the top 5 agents represented here are where the overwhelming majority of our risk is. The bars are the 5 and 95th percentile confidence, if you will, the variance around estimating that mean. And you say, well, the bars for those top 5 are all above, give or take a couple little things there, are all above the next 5, 10, whatever it is in the middle cluster. So if we don't have our act together for those top 5, maybe that's what we should be doing because the risk is higher. And then, of course, you might come back and say, well, why is the next one on the list that low? And if this because a parameter that's not well known could move it way up, or if one in the top cluster might move way down with the change of a parameter, I guess why we use the error bars or confidence bars is to get some assessment of what happens if you change those. But there are parameters that we don't know well that might move things in and out of the clusters. And this is just one way the tool can be used. And I want to point that out, and that the main product here is not to rank agents, although sometimes it feels that way, because this is an easy thing to understand, is my agent number one kind of question. The main product here is to look at this and understand what's putting agents at the top of the risk profile and ask what interventions might move that risk down. Okay, so to tighten the error bars and to reduce risk, we obviously are in this as a community. We get inputs from IBROG. There is the Interagency Bioterrorism Risk Assessment Working Group. There's other subject matter expert committees that are either called by us or we participate in. The BTRA is one source of identifying gaps in knowledge or these unknown or increasing error rate parameters. So BTRA is one. The population threat assessments are another way to do that. There are lots of other analyses, system studies and the like, and we try to take advantage of what's learned in those as we plan for the next BTRA and we make assessments. There's also intelligence, intelligence with the big I intelligence. Hopefully there's little I intelligence too. And you can imagine if you got very specific intelligence, that independent of where an agent, if you go back to the agent ranking, independent of where it was on the list, if you had explicit intelligence that someone was planning an attack and law enforcement saying, yeah, we think that's real, you'd want to put some energy into understanding that even if it's way to the right on that plot, because that kind of starts to change the whole game. So there's a reason there's so many things on the left, and part of the point here is the BTRA is not a recipe for, you know, BTRA says this, therefore U.S. biodefense policy must map exactly. It's one input of many. So we take advantage of all these inputs as well to identify gaps. We then look, now in terms of experiments, we look at what you can do technically. I mean, is it feasible to do an experiment to resolve this? We're certainly not going to do human experiments. Does it impact the risk? So if we do the experiment and we're done, does it actually change our assessment of risk? Or does it leave it the same? And then finally, does it improve our understanding in a way that lets us change something operationally? And if it fails these center three, it really doesn't much matter whether the experiment can be done or not. It's not going to be. So once things pass through the stoplight in the middle, We prioritize those based on the impact, and again, have to reconcile with the budget, which is part of our annual planning process. And that's approved by the department. Shifting gears a little bit, HSPD 18, which came out a year ago, 2 years ago maybe, I can't remember now, defines a vocabulary, so I'm stealing the vocabulary here, of traditional, enhanced, emerging, and advanced agents. And as we're looking at threats, one of the things we're trying to do is to establish a strategy for what are methods that might be additional complements to using this list of agents. I mean, if you go all the way back to when I first started talking about the risk assessment, I kind of preempted the whole discussion by starting with the far left with lists of agents, and so it's no wonder at the end a preferred product of outcome is a list of agents. And there are other things to look at, and I'll comment a little at the end, and that's part of what we're trying to figure out now. And so if you think of the list of agents and the top risks of those agents as kind of the first priorities in a portfolio, what are the next priorities and how do you set them? It's unlikely that the U.S. is going to economically invest enough to use a agent-by-agent strategy. I mean, look at the list of CDC select agents, look at every public health agent, anything that anyone's died of in the United States this year, and say, what if the U.S. were to mount a countermeasure program for each of those? That would be a lot of money, and I don't think that's going to happen. So what are the other strategies you do after you've done, you know, fix the number of agents, 10, 5, 100, whatever it is, there'll be some left. And so how do you do that? And I ask that as a question because we're still developing potential strategies, and I'll comment on some of the ones people have suggested to us, and the reason I say suggest is we have not finalized what we think would be the top strategy. CORE is our third program, the smallest one. I mentioned it's our anti-buggy whip campaign, and so it's it does several functions, and I break them out in, I think, three different charts here. One, and one of its largest investments, is what is the science and technology going on in these communities that have much larger investments than us. I mean, Jerry said we're a five-year, $250 million contract, 5 year with five possible extensions based on performance, I might add. So 10-year, $500 million contract, we hope. But that's nothing compared to what major pharmaceutical industry spend in 1 year. And so, you know, how can we learn from not just what we see coming out of pharmaceutical, but what they're planning as we try to look 5 years ahead. A lot of the brain power that's going to those activities, we'd like to understand what the trends are so that we can evaluate countermeasures and make a better assessment of where vulnerabilities may or may not be. And so this is hugely important. We have a relatively small activity. We take advantage of other groups' assessments and the like. And in fact, CORE in many extensions or many ways is our attempt to leverage other people's investments. So here it's leveraging pharmaceuticals, the agricultural industry, academia, the national labs, DOD as well as DOE labs and the like. And so the same thing's true as we move from science and technology trends to looking at things like dual use. There's some excellent reports, and I'm sure most people in the room have seen both of these. So we don't view ourselves as in the business of making lists of technologies for dual use. Other people have done that. We would like to understand what's the overall strategy for mixing these two types of functions together. How do we use these to predict the future, or not predict the future? How do we use these to better assess our risks in biodefense? And so, unfortunately, I don't have an answer to that. And this, I think, is my last chart. But things we've looked at is horizon scanning. Basically, you know, predicting the future gets easier the less farther out you look. So start here and start working out. My first-hand experience with that is, in the life sciences at least, is it doesn't work. And my example would be I chaired a futures group, and we made a list of 100 breakthroughs we thought would happen in 20 years, which for those of you who have ever had to do this 20 years is ridiculous. Yeah, everyone should be laughing at this. And so we got a slot to present to the larger strategy group, and unfortunately, I think I actually chaired this panel. So they said, oh, no, you don't have time to present 100. You have to cut it down quite a bit. So we eliminated 20 that we thought, well, not only won't it happen in 20 years, it won't happen in 50 years. And then our talk got delayed 3 months, and 5 of the 20 happened. And so our challenge is how to be sensible about this, recognizing that the major breakthroughs and ahas really aren't going to come out of a formal plan. And so one approach is horizon scanning, and I've just attempted to articulate why I think that has a hole in it. Another is to describe the world in terms of what we would do in response mode. So whether that response is public health, which I think is also listed on here somewhere else, or whatever your response is, describe the world in terms of what you would do if it happened to you. And so it's not really a prediction of the future. It's a mapping of the portfolio you want to have if. And another is to describe the world, and unfortunately, and I think for good reasons, they point out that Hasbro may not like it, but we usually use Mr. Potato Head for this, so instead I got a chimera out of the encyclopedia. But what if you describe the world, the pathogen world, in terms of mixes and matches? You know, I can add an interleukin to a pox virus. I can do this. I can do that. But the whole world is this mix and match chimera of different things. And so, I mean, this is very appealing to people in the who are trained in physical sciences and engineering, right? It's a reductionist view of the world. And again, I would go back and give more stories about how the life sciences that often doesn't quite work out as well as it does in physics or math or other areas. So that's another. The countermeasure approach, there's lots of different ways to do it. I'll just give an example, which is for any particular area that has you concerned, and let's just pick on one. DNA synthesis has been in the news a lot lately with the synthetic biology and Craig Venter's work with creating an organism from scratch. Well, if you had that ability, you should also be able to then to chemically and through genome synthesis create live vaccines from scratch. And so if you concede the technology is going to be this mature, what would you do with it for a defense point of view? And so I'm just going through the different inputs we've had, and as you'll see, every one of these, you say, well, that sounds good, but, and that's why I want to walk through these. Support intelligence is another one. We don't know as much as we'd like. We never will. And so I do think there's a justification for we should know more, but kind of like horizon scanning, you know, when are you done, given that there still will be ahas. Self-monitoring and this has been proposed by several of the societies associated with microbiology and other life science areas. Hugely important, I think, to have standards of ethics. Engineering organizations have had these for years. Do I think it changes the overall international flavor? I think it does a little, but not perhaps as much as we'd like. Enhanced public health, that's kind of self-evident. Host-based immunologic, one way to view the world is all that matters is people. And if I were at the U.S. Animal Health Association, where I'm a board, I would say all that matters is animals. But since I'm talking about people today, it's people. So you can define the world in terms of the immune system of the human, and I'm going to describe the world in terms of what evades or overcomes the human immune system. That is a many-billion-dollar initiative for NIH and industry. And so for little us, is an unlikely strategy to help us evaluate risk for the U.S. government and biodefense, but it would be wonderful if that were undertaken. And then finally, international controls, which I suspect half the people in the room at least know more about the options for that than I do. I certainly have studied the Biological Weapons Convention and have participated in some of the meetings. I think it's also hugely important. How NBAC is part of that is a history yet to be written, I think. As an FFRDC, obviously, we support the department. It's not my place to decide, but I think it's hugely important, this overall, how do we help reduce the risk as we look to the future? Oh, that wasn't the last chart. This is my brag sheet. So what have we done in the last year and a half? Our operational forensics was not interrupted, and for those of you who have ever taken over an ISO operation, had to hire 40 people in one day, this was huge, huge. The second bioterrorism risk assessment was turned in 10 days ago. 12 days ago, and so that's now checked. A Safety Act, for those of you familiar with it, I believe we're the only national lab who's gotten that designation. We have all our plans in place and our advisory committees, and final note, showing my Battelle colors here, even though we were a startup company, and by the way, by startup, I really do mean startup, the little yellow sticky with the stick figure with a dress on it was because we had no signs at all when we moved into our building, and so our our first female staff members all agreed that we needed signs on the bathrooms first and foremost. And since then, a mere 14 months ago, we've had blood drives, backpack campaigns. We are a founding member of the Maryland Science Olympiad for middle school and high school kids. And so we're really pushing on the overall partnership in the community. So with that, I'm open for questions.
Thank you very much, Pat. I think rather than me taking the chance to ask a few, we have a room of people that are eminently qualified for that. Let me turn to the audience. I could ask you to identify yourselves and wait for a microphone if you could.
Well, I had two questions, actually. You had in your charts HSPD-10, and that it requires biannual and end-to-end assessment of bioterrorism, and the first bullet was adversary capabilities and intent.
Milton, I know you, but if you can identify yourself for everybody else, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. Milton Leitenberg, a senior research scholar at Center for International Security Studies, University of Maryland School of Public Policy. I apologize. Now, just two, three weeks ago, the U.S. government released its latest appreciation of terrorism, 60, 70 pages. The section on bioterrorism is 29 lines, three paragraphs. There is nothing there. The only reference is to the pre-2001 Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan mention. We don't know, as best I know, the intelligence community has no knowledge that any of that is continuing. I've seen the first iteration of the risk assessment. I'm not good in math. It seemed to me all irrelevant. You have no threat that you know about or that the U.S. government knows about. And so what's the meaning of all of that? The second question is Jerry's third point, which was that there's an arms control aspect. And, of course, some of us do know the Korch briefing, and some of us have written about it. And there are a whole list of points in there that singularly and cumulatively could be considered a breach of the Biological Weapon Convention, Article 1. And it's notable that you didn't say a single word about that.
Let me start with your comment, I guess, question on HSPD-10. I believe the consensus is that there are threats and that biodefense programs in the United States are called for. I'm not the person to make that case here or anywhere. It's an input, as you saw in our charts, that we take from others as consensus as well as non-consensus inputs. So apologize, I'm not going to add more details here and can't. Your comment on the biological weapons and the toxin convention, I would love to work with you then on how to convey our appreciation for abiding by that. Certainly there are measures in that affect me personally if we're not, and I have no intent of violating the conventions, and neither does DHS. So if there's something in these charts or in what I said that appears inconsistent with that, I'd love to work with you to find out how to stop sending that message, because that's absolutely not my organization's or our sponsors' intent.
Jonathan Tucker, James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies. Dr. Fitch, in your introduction, you mentioned that you would like to be able to list all of the projects that will take place at NBAC, I assume including classified or even black projects, but you said you had not yet received authorization. Can you explain why that has not yet been authorized?
Did it again. The question was why I can't release a set of titles, and it's strictly administrative. We're still, as you might imagine, standing up different processes. Jerry invited me to give this talk almost, in fact, possibly over a year ago, and even with that and with pieces of this having been approved in advance, it still took 6 weeks to do that, 2 weeks internally for my own processes. We don't have a fully vetted security review process yet, and so it's strictly a prioritization. Our strategic plan, which is fully unclassified, and I apologize, I should have brought copies today. I was looking at the rain and the the Metro and decided not to lug much. But we put a lot of effort into that being able to be released, and it is, like I said, full open for distribution. And so it's those trade-offs. We put it into that rather than something else. I don't think there'll be an issue. And again, I can see the value of disclosing those. And at the same time, I think there's an appreciation and sophistication in the community that the outcomes of some of those projects could well be sensitive. And I think that's a better conversation to have.
Just a quick follow-up, because at present, the CBM declaration that the United States issues to other states' parties to the BWC does not include classified biodefense activities. So that would be a change in U.S. policy were you to publish the lists of at least the titles of all of the classified projects underway.
That's right. And I should point out that the overwhelming majority of our projects are unclassified, and that's one reason I don't think we're going to have a problem doing this. I mean, it's I don't know what the percentage is. I've never counted up, but there's very few classified projects.
But John, let me add, if he is able to produce a list of all the projects that NBAC is doing, that would be coverage of NBAC, and it would be a different question as to whether other U.S. government agencies chose to follow suit.
Bob McCrate, George Washington University. Just in the interest of balance, before I ask my question, there's a lot of circumstances where the United States has to worry about transparency. Many other parties to the BWC are not quite as concerned about transparency as we are. There's also the question of declarations and how you go about validating what other countries say or don't say in their declarations about bugs they have or don't have. And I think it's important in context to look at that. My question is, how do you see the NBAC playing a role in helping us with future situations where there's a new or novel disease, zoonotic disease, and helping us distinguish as rapidly as possible between a disease that brought to us by Mother Nature versus a disease brought to us by a terrorist organization?
So in our forensics program, that's easy. We get involved when law enforcement tells us to be involved. At the science level, it's a little more complicated. We collaborate with the CDC extensively, several groups there, including the Special Pathogens Group, and have already been available at their request to support investigations. I'd like to see, and it's premature to say because we don't have our labs stood up yet, I'd like to see those collaborations expand. And again, this is the science we're involved in is so similar to what CDC, these other organizations do. I think it's the question, the way you phrased it, sounds more like a CDC mission. Once bioterrorism suspected, law enforcement brings it to us. I don't know that will change. It seems like the right role for us is to support the CDC in those kind of investigations.
Let me fill a little time here while I encourage people to keep coming up with questions and play back to the first of the three reasons I think that your facility is of quite a bit of interest, and that's sort of the health and safety aspects, and particularly with the community. I wonder if you could say a few words about how you're interacting with the town of Frederick, the officials, the population, as to how your facility is going to be operating.
So we've had a variety of meetings with elected officials and community leaders. I think I'd only been there 2 months, met with the mayor, felt like I was in California again. Water and traffic were the top two issues. The interaction with the community is an ongoing activity. Part of what we do has nothing to do with sort of the safety issue. It has to do with being a company that's trying to be a value added to the Frederick area. And that's one reason I'm so proud of the stuff we had on the last slide in terms of what we're doing in science, technology, engineering, and math education. The sort of the bigger issue I think Jerry's alluding to is, you know, how do you make sure you have best practices in safety? And so we on the Fort Detrick, on the campus there, have NIH standing up. Peter Darling's the lab director. George Korch is the head of the USAMRIT right now. And the three of us, we don't have identical missions, and therefore we don't have identical science to do. And so there are parts of our safety programs that are going to be different. That said, we're working to understand when different makes sense and is good, and when different is because we did them independently and working quite a bit. There's been some workshops on things like occupational exposures that NIH hosted. And so we're pushing pretty hard on understanding, you know, where the science requires us to customize. And I have staff, for instance, training at the CDC right now. You know, we obviously are training at USAMRIID under their safety envelope for the forensics work we do. And I'm in the middle of another site visit, I think my third or fourth high containment lab, as we start to finalize our processes before the building even gets activated. So, you know, I think with the people who live in Frederick and the broader community, their expectation should be that we look for best practices, adopt them, customize them where it provides enhanced safety, and that there's some community vetting of that, whether it's with University of Texas Galveston, who has a high containment lab and a larger one coming online, or the CDC, or the lab in Winnipeg, you know, to make sure that it's not just sort of an isolated learn-as-you-go kind of thing.
Christine in the back.
Hi, Christine Rovner with Student Pugwash USA. Maybe mine's more of a comment or trying to get a little bit more clarification from you on a comment you made about scientists self-monitoring as one of your challenges, but you seem to be playing it down a little bit in terms of the wider range of challenges that you face, and that, you know, it's important for scientists to have ethics, but this may not be at the forefront of your efforts. We work with students in the sciences and engineering, and over the past, you know, couple of years, we've been doing programs with undergraduates and graduate students with the National Academies, Federation of American Scientists, and others, and have been very surprised at how new dual use seems to be to students in the biological sciences. This is not a concept that they've been widely exposed to. And so with your comments sort of playing down some of that self-monitoring, I also fear that it has the effect of not trickling down to those who are in the education sector who need to be raising the young biologists who are going to come work for you with that frame of mind, so that at least they're being trained with that ethics and self-monitoring ingrained rather than sort of an afterthought or something else that's being played down. So I was just hoping you'd elaborate a little bit on your comments.
I think those are great points, and it's more that, and you worded it very well. I mean, we have a responsibility in that. It's not one I would expect us to be the leader of, though. I mean, and my point is more like it would have been for any of the other ones on the list. If that's all you do, you can see it's sort of the preaching the commandments to people who come to church. You know, that's the whole for that strategy. I'm fully supportive that it has value, and I certainly think the life sciences are so different than the physical sciences and engineering. And I know when I moved from the human genome program into biodefense, there is this whole way of viewing the science that's not how you do it. And so I think there is an educational opportunity that has a potential very large impact. But just like all the other things on that list, you can see doing that really well and has a positive value, just like almost everything else on the list does, but you could predict how it would be incomplete. Right. That was the point. If I sound like I trivialized it, I didn't intend to, but it's also very hard to do. The life sciences are just culturally different, I think, than the other sciences that kind of with World War II embraced defense in a way, I think, despite some of the really big name life scientists who've committed part of their careers to biodefense, it's such a small fraction compared to some big name scientists who worked in radar or pick your favorite technology, you know, high-end computing, which, you know, sort of the national security back and forth academic kind of metrics is much more common, I think. And so there's a lot of ground to cover, but doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. Isn't there somebody over here?
Back in the next, Alan.
Resource, Inc. In regard to your threat characterization efforts, Of course, you know that homegrown terrorists may be our most likely threat in many cases. I was wondering if you're involved with tracking the locations of select agents around the U.S. and their movements of select agents, and if so, are you also integrated with DHS's biosurveillance integration system, national biosurveillance?
So we are not the NBAC tracking select agents. The biointegration, NBIS, biointegration surveillance, I'm trying to remember what it stands for too. We are not part of per se. We're just like I showed those two reports, one from the National Academies, one from the Royal Society. We're a consumer of their integrated products, just like we would be with DOD GEIS and other ones. It's part of our overall currency to know what's going on in the world. But we don't do experimental work for them. We don't do analysis for them. Yeah, so the forensics is, I should have pointed this out, forensics is an operational program in the sense that real casework for real law enforcement comes to us. In the threat area, since we don't have any labs activated now, we do analysis and assessments, and so we're not the way GEIS or NBIS would be part of an operational chain that's, you know, providing ready policy support. Ours is a longer horizon policy support right now.
Alan, I think you're next.
Thanks. Alan Pearson, Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Two questions. One, I wanted to go back to the threat characterization. You had a slide where you showed all the inputs into prioritization and so on. My question is basically, since NBAC is one of those inputs, it's conducting the threat, the risk assessment, and in fact some of those other inputs actually input into the risk assessment process, so there's some iteration, if you will. And NBAC is also then filling the gaps. I was wondering if you could describe if there's firewalls or anything in between those two processes so that you don't become what people sometimes call self-licking ice cream cone. And the second question is whether, and I apologize to other people in the room if this is too far down into the weeds, but I'm wondering if you could describe and explain perhaps your relationship with the Knowledge Center out in California, which carries on activities, some of which seem to have quite a bit of overlap with what you're doing. So if you could describe that interaction.
Again, it goes off on its own. On the self-licking ice cream cone question, there's a lot of inputs that are common to the BTRA that are also on this left hand. And that's because the whole process is iterative. And if this had been a defining report to be done one time, I think the self-licking ice cream cone would be a real issue because you'd have this one report that you wrote for yourself to do experiments. Because it goes through all kinds of consensus review, consensus is the wrong term, review and inputs from multiple federal agencies, review from other peer experts. The BTRA is a report frozen in time that basically showcases the tool applied, the way it's been applied over that two-year period and upgrade of those 2 years. And then the real activity is how do you use that tool while you're developing the next better one, but in parallel you're also using it to do scenarios, get a better understanding of if you change this, what impact does it have, and the like. And so each of the things on the left actually has a different role. So if in some logic sense the BTRA is looking across the world, across all pathogens, all terrorist groups, all state-sponsored level things, so sort of in my basement through to, you know, large multi-million-dollar program, integrating all over all those, what are the relative risks? The best assessment we can do identifying the confidence bars. The PTA, the population threat assessment, says, well, for the risks that have floated up to the top, either from the BTRA or from intelligence assessment or anything else on the left side, before we go develop a countermeasure, let's look at what a plausible worst-case scenario is. Because shouldn't we develop a countermeasure against that? Not against the averaged across the whole possible spectrum BTRA. So they actually address two different things, highly overlapping, as you might guess, right? To construct them, you need the same kind of references, and why would you say you can grow this much of such and such an agent on a Petri dish, this size kind of question. But there are two different perspectives on the problem. The BKC works on these population threat assessments, and I know quite a bit about it since it was under me at Lawrence Livermore when I was program leader there. And that's an important input to a larger process that Homeland Security then uses for an evaluation, and if it reaches a certain threshold, it's then taken to another department, Health and Human Services, for countermeasure development. And the process isn't so linear because Health and Human Services has to weigh in on how the countermeasures and the response are all measured and what the effect on the population is. And so it would be self-licking if it was a nice clean circle like this, but it actually has all these branches at every step. And so I would say the BTRA is kind of the selection of themes. The PTA and other studies, systems analyses, are evaluation specific scenarios. So they're very consequence oriented. So that's one half of what the BTRA does. The BKC, sort of to finish off on that, answered half of the question on the BKC, also does things we don't do. There's a reach back capability at the BKC. We're not, well, in forensics, we have a 24/7. We're not sitting by the phone waiting for a threat question to respond to. We're working on the BTRA, which is a 2-year cycle. So they have a role in the overall response assessment area, which we don't do at all.
I'm Marv Pauly. I'm a Jefferson Science Fellow in VCIBW at Department of State. And one of the questions I have about the risk assessment is, and you alluded to this a little bit in your own talk, are we focusing too much on human disease and ignoring the possibility of infecting crop plants or our domestic animals? You know, when you look at the little glitch of making some ethanol to the world food supply, it wouldn't take much to really upset the balance.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the cartoons I had and most of the charts were from the 2006, because when I turned these in for approval, the 2008 wasn't officially done. The 2008 does look at more than human. One of the reasons everything's so human-centric is the top parameter that we were asked to evaluate against was death, human casualties. And that, as soon as you say that's the top issue I care about, that drives a whole bunch of priorities in how you set the studies up and the like. So when you start to add either illness, human or other, and economics, so you add dollar, and it's hard to do those together, so you end up with sort of three separate studies. And I think that may be where we're heading for 2010, is do you do all three and kind of have a risk against money, a risk against people getting sick, which also influences money, and a risk of mortality. And so and it's funny, the last briefing I got to sit in the audience for the BTRA for, I sat next to a plant pathologist, a very well-respected one, and her question immediately was, where are the plant diseases? And so there would be value in that. One of the things I think for the department to assess in the, as we look to 2010 is, this tool has a great organizational value, where is its limit in terms of policy influence? It's nice to kind of avoid the scientists promoting their favorite pathogen kind of thing that can happen without the tool. But that doesn't necessarily mean that this tool has to model all the possible threats. And that's one of the things I think the policy level, and that's not for me to decide, do you want to extend it to plants more fully? Do you want to extend it to animals more fully? And do you want the economic models to be really sophisticated, or do you want them to be just sort of order of magnitude? Is it as bad as a hurricane, or is it not? So those are all, and the overall policy question is, you spend money on that versus, understanding the other things. So those are, I think you raise good points.
Can I just follow up? When you're talking about death, are you talking about starvation?
As well as death from the disease, and if so, do you take into account foreign death? Because I know a lot of these are based on U.S.
No, the current studies don't do that. Yeah, that's a.
Let me jump here. In some of the earlier discussions on whether food is considered a critical infrastructure, I think the conclusion of many of those analyses is that you can certainly have massive disruption by attacking the food system, but given the number of alternatives to any one food source, I think going from that to starvation might be hard to get. But of course, if you're figuring out other parts of the world where they're much more reliant on single crops, then you have to bring that back in.
I think the broader thing to do if you want to represent food well, I think, is the tool has to become international, which I think is more, certainly far more than our current scope is to look at. But I think that that's what you'll see with corn production and the like. If ethanol, it won't be U.S. supermarkets that are depleted. So.
I'm Mary Hansen from DHS Science and Technology Interagency Programs. I've got a quick question for you, but first I'll make a comment about the physical plant. You made a point of saying you're not in charge of that. And I think we're very aware in DHS of the need to, of course, do the right things, but also reassure the public the physical plant is safe. And in that capacity, just in FYI, we have asked invited Y-12, which is a DOE facility, which specializes in enriched uranium, to do a physical assessment of NBAC, because the point about the interagency work that we're all trying to do inside the Beltway but elsewhere is to take advantage of each other's expertise. If anybody knows physical plant security, it should be them. So I just wanted to comment that, you know, I was looking at who else already does this that we should include. My question for you is putting all the scientific models and the scientific discussion and tone and so on and structure for this aside, do you feel you're doing the right thing, and how in the world can you answer that question for yourself? I know that's a huge question, but, yeah, you know, it's difficult, complicated, serious, scary stuff.
So how
do you work through that?
We're all victims of our own histories, right? And so I'm a believer in portfolios, and I think the risk assessment fits in a portfolio of assessments that are needed to make good policy decisions. I think it fits in a portfolio for how to make science investments. It is not 100% driver for either of those. And so I think the balancing act between how to fill out the rest of whatever percent you assign to the portfolio is huge. And how you do that with a leaning towards the future, how you do that looking to new countermeasures that Health and Human Services and others like DOD and industry might be developing, I think there's a possibility that 20 or 30% is more important to our 10-year future than the sort of list of agents kind of assessments. But you have to start with what you can do. And I think that's the lesson of the last two BTRAs, is when you do all that and look at it, you say, well, now we have our handle around that, but it's not the whole picture. And so I think with some confidence, many of us believe that the assessment is getting accurate enough. And so the question now is, what do you need in addition to that? Do you need a much more accurate assessment, or do you need a different assessment that complements it? And yeah, I'm giving away my bias, obviously, right? So it's a policy decision, and I think, you know, one reason we're not sort of promoting the self-licking ice cream cone where we're at the left end and the right end and, you know, churn in the middle is I think there are other perspectives to be had than the probabilistic risk assessment one, and they're important ones. And let me make a comment about the physical structure. And Jamie Johnson, who's head of the Office of National Lab, would kick me for not having done it on my own. The building being constructed is a state-of-the-art high-containment lab that was designed in consultation with other groups and companies that have built several of the nicer ones around the world, not just in the United States. And it's a very nice facility that has built into it the things you need to run both a secure and a very safe operation. So the building's not going to be our issue for safety and security. It's the management challenge of, you know, people are people, and how do you train and indoctrinate and do human performance measures so that folks can recognize error precursors. And so the facility is as they do their coats of epoxy and stuff, every time I go through it, I enjoy it, but it is a state-of-the-art facility.
Thank you. Jonathan Tucker again, Center for Nonproliferation Studies. One of the most controversial aspects of the Korch briefing was that it implied that NBAC would do prospective studies involving genetically engineered pathogens to think about what might be possible rather than what you have clear intelligence has been done by other countries. And I just wondered, is that still on the agenda for NBAC, looking at doing more prospective analyses, including laboratory work with genetically modified pathogens?
Did it again. That's not on any of our plans now, and I don't see it cropping up. I mean, basically, I think the the phrase John Vitko used when we first got there was, we won't create threats in order to study them. And I'm, and if people have ideas on this, I'd love to hear them. I am still trying to figure out scientifically if there's actually a stronger case to be made for studying what happens in nature versus creating anything anyway. I mean, it's 10 to the 31 viruses on the planet, 10 to the 30 bacteria. Those are numbers you can't even fit in a computer. That's a huge experiment going on every day. And so aren't we better off collaborating with, you know, hospitals and their antibiotic resistance programs than going in our labs and trying to figure out what might happen? So we're still trying to figure, you know, what the right collaborations are. Excuse me for that, but the answer to the creation, no, absolutely not.
Let me jump in on this. I think, again, I'll let a couple of questions percolate, but on behalf of at least one of my colleagues who couldn't come, I want to follow up on what you said earlier about the things that motivate why one might not be completely transparent, and you would focus on the vulnerabilities. This is the area we wouldn't necessarily want to help people trying to hurt us know exactly how to do it. But to drill down a little bit further, one set of things you would do to look at vulnerabilities are sort of paper studies and analyses on, you know, what would be the effect of this model, and that's a different set of questions than are raised by laboratory work. When one goes into wet lab work, you're asking questions about nature, which, if it's a public health concern or a disease mechanism concern, may be of interest to others who may be publishing it anyway. So I'm sort of wondering if there's a third category, and if you can elaborate on an addition about things that have a vulnerability content to them that wouldn't want to not want to divulge, that don't necessarily mirror what's going on in the open literature, but don't necessarily represent paper studies either. The sort of area where it would be classified wet work in some sense. And it's kind of elaborates on Jonathan's question. You're sort of not going down the road of, gee, how bad could this be? Let's check. But is it possible to get a little more specific on that, or is it going to be kind of question-driven or event-driven?
Well, I think it's always going to be question-driven. And the example I'd give where I think that could happen is that there's a vaccine or antibiotic that's in the stockpile, and for whatever reason, there's information that leads you to believe there's a particular strain that defeats that countermeasure, and you'd like to study that either in vitro or in an animal model. And you can probably create a title that you wouldn't mind sharing publicly, but you almost certainly wouldn't want to line up the strain with the countermeasure and tell people what the outcome was unless it, in fact, does protect against it. And so that's very much the kind of experiment I would expect us to be able to state. We're doing experiments like that. Again, we don't have labs right now for doing that kind of work, but would not expect to identify the strain or the countermeasure.
Just to take my own advice for those who don't have the advantage of seeing the sign in front of me, let me identify myself. I'm Gerald Epstein at the Homeland Security Program here at CSIS. Todd, I think you had a question.
Todd Redhart with the Technical Support Working Group. Looking at the risk assessment process, okay, the masters in risk assessment was the financial industry, and over the last year we have discovered, despite their investment of billions of dollars and hundreds, if not thousands, of very smart people, their risk assessment process was fundamentally flawed, and we are now paying the consequences of that. Is there any intent of kind of taking the lessons learned that are coming out of the financial industry to go back and review at a very fundamental level your risk assessment process? Because I suspect, you know, you didn't pick up on the contaminated heparin that was coming out of China. I think more people have died from that than have died from the anthrax attacks. And what if that had been, what if, or could that be a deliberate attack, and how does your risk assessment factor that in?
Yeah, those are very good questions, and we are looking at the formal method of the risk assessment and considering other options. They have to be approved by the department as well as the current customers of the risk assessment. This methodology, for those who aren't familiar with it, also has been used in nuclear regulatory industry for power plants. And it's very well attuned for things like that, where you have an engineered system, you can do reliability testing component by component, and when you add the stochastic element that you're not designing the components, you know, the ability to extrapolate gets much harder. And so I go back to what I claim the value of the tool is. It puts all the information in one construct. Is it a predictive tool? No. That's why I'm asking what are other ideas and other strategies for doing that. Do I think it's had great value? Yes. Do I think we should do one every 2 years for the next several decades? Probably not. But we need something like this to rack and stack all the different components of a complex problem. And every time we learn something new, it has to be added.
And the NRC process failed, the 3 mile island failed at Chernobyl.
That's right.
Because they didn't work on combined complex casualties at the same time. And
that's right. Right. The comment was that even the NRC application to engineered systems fails. It's only as good as your assumptions. And even then, I would claim when it comes to predicting the future as opposed to helping you put an analytical wrapper around what you think you understand now, as soon as you start thinking it predicts the future is where you get in trouble.
Bob McRae, George Washington University. Pat, I think you mentioned somewhere on your slides about international activities. Could you comment a little bit about what you think the short, long-term agenda would be in that score, please?
So right now our international activities are entirely, I believe, entirely forensics. And so as you can imagine, to have collections and there's value in sharing the assays from a program point of view, forensics is already out the chute, and I don't have permission to share them. When I do, people will start hearing about it. The science side of this, life science is an international enterprise, and so I see us ending up, whether it's for particular pathogens that are endemic in other countries, and so they therefore have much better research programs than we do here. If we were to start studying animal and plants, I'm certainly not going to suddenly go out and hire a whole team of people to do animal and plant pathogens. So depending on what diseases or what pathogens, I can see those collaborations expanding internationally as well. Right now, I'm pretty sure all our international collaborations are for forensics, though. All the examples I can think of are forensics. So.
Let me encourage anybody who has additional questions to see, come up and talk with Dr. Fitch offline. I want to thank you. I've tried to break the mold a little bit of the standard one-hour talk here. I want to have a little longer so we can get a little bit deeper, and we've done that, but I don't want to drive you past the point at which people should be able to gain. Let me just ask us all to thank our speaker again for this talk. Sure.